Today we'll be visiting with Mr. Ernst Zundel, a publisher located in Toronto, Canada. Mr. Zundel, thank you very much for giving us this time today.
No problem, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, we've noticed that you've been getting an awful lot of notoriety around the world due to the type of books that you've been distributing.
Right.
Books that deny the validity of the Holocaust and even go so far as to deny that Anne Frank's diary was valid.
Yeah, I'm guilty as charged.
Well, why are you doing this?
Well, first of all, I am a lover of truth, and I think that there could not possibly a sane world, an orderly world, normal society inhabited by normal people, there could be no function of government. Nothing could work without truth, you know, because if the manufacturer of a car that sells you a car states that this car will do those things, that it will stop when you, in effect, put the foot on the brake, and it will start when you put the foot on the accelerator, you believe that he is giving you truthful information, and that when you put on the foot on the accelerator, it's not the brake and vice versa, you know? Truth. Truth is the basic element to our total existence, and just because intellectual crooks, liars, hypocrites, misinformers, disinformers have thought that in the realm of ideas or in the realm of history, they could not apply this rather strict standard, does not mean that it doesn't apply there. It does. And our society reflects in its dissolution, where we see it everywhere, the lack of truth. You know, in other words, the most skillful man, given false information, will make erroneous judgments. It's like in a computer. The computer, however brilliant, expensive, sophisticated it might be, is always going to reflect garbage in, garbage out.
But most of the world accepts these things as valid truth. Now, how can you say that they're not?
Well, as strange as it may seem, and I'm as guilty as the rest of the world, I also believed in the Holocaust, lock, stock and barrel. I believed that the diary of Anne Frank was real, and that the Germans did terrible things to these people, and I thought that, being German myself, I had to atone for the guilt of my own ethnic group. And one of the reasons why I'm sitting here in North America in front of these cameras with you is basically I felt guilty about being German, and I wanted to have nothing to do, since I had nothing in common, since I certainly didn't intend to hurt poor Anne Frank or subsequent Anne Franks or any Jews in my life. I wanted to have nothing to do with German people, and so I moved right out of the German area. I came to North America thinking that I could escape this whole scene. You can't escape it. Once you are born into an area, you carry your Germanness with you till the end of your days. And as it turns out, my children who were born here in North America, not entirely of a German mother, but of a French-Canadian mother, they also carry it with them. So there is a stigma attached to you, and the best way that you can overcome it is through truth. And I very soon found out, through research available to me and material documentation in North America, that the Holocaust, as I had been presented it in the school in Germany, was totally false. That it was largely World War II, post-World War II propaganda, specifically designed to achieve the guilt which it had produced in me. And I began to travel far and wide. North America was good to me. I have an excellent trade craftsman in the advertising business. And I roamed the world as a young man, seeking truth from people on both sides of the issues, the Allies and the Germans. And I suddenly realized that the truth was far more on the German side than on the Allied side, especially when Jewish individuals came forth, consented to give interviews to me, and allow me to share their research and their research findings. And instrumental in it was a German Jew by the name of Joseph G. Burg, who had been in Eastern Europe and apparently was part of a Russian commission when the Soviets moved into the European area occupied by the Germans for a little while, and he went in an official capacity into those camps, which he said were liberated, found no gas chambers, Now, he was a Jewish writer, an author of some 10 or 12 books, telling me that there were no gas chambers in the camps that he was one of the first Soviet officials to go into.
But we've got thousands of Jews that are very upset over what you've been doing, and they say that it's true. In fact, there are hundreds of them who claim to have survived these death camps. Well, how do you explain that?
First of all, if they were death camps, believe me, I'm a German, and we would have found methods to make sure that they were dead and didn't survive it. You see, the best proof that there was no extermination program are all these millions of survivors who are collecting pensions from the German people via the German government. The last statistic that I have seen was 4,300,000 pension claims paid for by the German government. And these 4,300,000 pension claims, 40% of those people lived in Israel. So you can assume that about 40% of them at least were Jewish. Also, many of them lived in Melbourne, Australia, and Johannesburg, South Africa, Rio de Janeiro, Skokie in the United States, Toronto, Montreal, so on. So many of those 4,300,000 were Jewish. Now, an extermination program, that's what the name given to it by the Allied propagandists, means to exterminate people. You usually start an extermination program, as we have seen by the Soviets, who are past masters at this, with the elite. The Spaniards went after the king of the Indians in Central America, and the Soviets went after the elite in Eastern Europe and in Russia proper. And the Polish officer corps, for instance, that was killed in Katyn by the Soviets, is the best proof of how to run an efficient extermination program. You round them up and you shoot them in the neck and you bury them. You know, no fuss, no bother, and you plant trees on top of it. Now, they were caught by the Germans, and the Germans had this international commission constituted of Swiss individuals, Bulgarians, and so on, and also Allied prisoners of war, some of them in the rank of general, from Canada, from America, from Britain, as they were exhuming these bodies. Now, in other words, there's always evidence of some sort. There are always a few witnesses to it. And here we have an elite of Jewry, traveling around the world, living in other parts of the world, all of them claiming to be just survivors of this extermination program, but strangely enough, many of the spokesmen are university types. Albert Einstein, he left Nazi Germany. How many rabbis left Nazi Germany? Kempner, the man who came back to prosecute the Germans in an American uniform, he was a high-ranking police official of the Prussian Interior Ministry in 1932. His job was in the German government of the Weimar Republic to actually hunt Nazis, make the Nazis' life difficult in Germany. Now, if the Germans had an extermination program in mind, the Nazis, that is, they would, the first guy you should think that they would nail is Kempner. You see, if their intention was to do harm to Jews in a blanket thing, the first ones they would nail would be the potential leaders. It's always the same.
How do you explain there were many Allied officers, high-ranking officers, that testified that they saw the bodies, the evidence was there, and in fact, much of this testimony was used in Nuremberg. Now, were these men lying, or?
Well, first of all, we have to go back to the mood in 1945. The world was at that time on the apex of highly stimulated emotions due to propaganda, largely, and war fever and deprivation. The people, there was a kind of a polarization, let's call that, you know, on both sides. And the Germans had suffered through the worst genocidal bombing campaign that any civilian population ever had to suffer in the whole world. It's interesting at this point to point out that in all of England, during the entire Blitz of London and the raid on England, in the beginning of the war and during the war, only 35,000 people died due to German bombs. Now that's fewer people than in a small bombing raid in Germany, when the city of Dresden is considered. Wesel, Hamburg, München, Frankfurt, and so on. I mean, they were these were genocidal raids. There's no other thing for it, because they were conducted not against the elite, the way the Soviets did to the Polish officers, but they were conducted against men, women, children, babies, even against people, Allied prisoners in prison camps and concentration camp inmates. You know, it was just a blanket extermination of whatever was in the path of these massive bomber streams was exterminated in the most cruel way. Even if the gas chamber lie was true, the Germans still would look better, because they would have killed their people humanely, painlessly. I can tell you, as one of the survivors of Allied bombing raids, what it was like to be at the receiving end of those phosphorus bombs coming down that would attach itself to the skin, and as soon as it was exposed to air, would burn. You put it in the water, it would stop burning, and you take it back out, and you would again be a flaming torch. So many bombs and phosphor bombs were dropped on these German cities that the asphalt and the streets was melting, so that the streets and the sidewalks where the people were walking were actually like riverbeds of flames, and that the surfaces of rivers and lakes in the parks of those cities were aflame. There was no escape from that. These German people died the most horrible deaths. So there was a Holocaust on our side. On the Allied side, from what my research has found, what the French Jewish professor Dom Merck has found, what the French former member of parliament, communist or even socialist member of the French National Assembly found, Professor Razinier, no gas chambers for the extermination of people existed in those German camps.
You feel then that these officers didn't tell the truth?
These officers, if they were officers, usually as Judge Wennerström, a judge from Illinois, said upon moving back to the United States after these trials in Europe, that they are recent immigrants, some of them not even naturalized, aliens, speaking with strange accents, that he confronted over there as interrogators and support staff and so on. And the very way that the court in Nuremberg was set up, it was totally slanted against the accused. Yeah. Also, there was no appeal against it. You see, the hallmark of true justice, civilized justice, is always that there are a number of steps of appeal. If appeal is denied in the United States, that would be immediately cruel and unusual punishment. You see, if there is no authority that you can appeal to, it's really ultimately judicial murder. Because there are people who do make errors. And you should think that when the eyes of the world were upon these people collected there at Nuremberg, they should have had at least the intelligence and the decency, as civilized people, most of them were, to allow for an appeal process, but no appeal process was allowed. Also, the court was not even composed of neutrals, but it was entirely made up of the victors. You know, I mean, this is just like it's a kangaroo court. The moment when the one aggrieved party sits in judgment over you, and they supply interrogators, prosecutors, they have a choice of which defense lawyer is going to be allowed to practice and which one is not going to be allowed to practice, you know. They can block documents, they can stop witnesses from appearing for the defense. There is no appeal against the judges, who also are supplied by the victor. They also supply the executioners. There is no justice. This is just a kind of a mockery of justice. It was only possible because the Germans had lost the war, and this propaganda about exterminations and all the cruelty and so on was so rife at the time that the mass of the people and the world at large would even have allowed this kind of mockery of justice, you see? If it had been taken place 2-3 years later, when the passions, human passions stirred up by war and so on, had subsided, these Germans would never have been convicted. And one of my main goals in life, as long as I live, will be to get a new look at Nuremberg and to get a revision of these judgments, if not a declaration from an international body to say that this was a travesty of justice and that it is struck from the annals of history, and that we get prime time television, and I mean by global link up with satellites, to make sure that the German people are exonerated of the falsehoods that were promulgated and the vindictive judgments that were handed out against the leaders of Germany. These men were no more guilty than their counterparts in the Allied fields. On the contrary, research will prove that the Germans were far more innocent. So,
okay. This is 10 minutes.
Right. It's very interesting. An American general, General George S. Patton, observed these same things in his writings home. And he also mentioned these strange people that wore American uniforms that seemed to be running things at Nuremberg. Could you talk a little more about that?
Well, we have it down pat subsequent to the trials in Nuremberg, but there is nothing that would presuppose that it didn't also happen before the actual trials or during the interrogations in Nuremberg, because the Van Roden Commission that was struck by Congress when the international clamor became so loud because the brutality that was visited upon some of these German inmates, both men and women in these camps, especially at the hands of Americans, in quote, and they found out that the men who did the torturing, and I mean the most brutal and vicious tortures that you will ever imagine. It was like out of the annals of the Soviet Cheka or GPU and KVD. They would, for instance, bring in priests, men dressed up as priests, walking up to these young men or young women and taking their confessions. They said, well, your night is going to be tonight, you're going to be shot tonight, and you may as well make a bare breast of it and kind of spill the beans and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, in effect, they were nothing but Americans, again, in quote, taking these confessions. Then there was hooding, where they would put a black hood over a man and then punch him and kick him. They would put matches under their fingernails, just like in medieval times, just perfectly ridiculous. And the men's names were part of the investigation, and they turned out to be Jews. Pearl and Rosenzweig and people like that. And they all were immigrants from Germany or from Central Europe that had gone to America and had become part of the war crime staff, as was the assistant prosecutor, as I said, Kempner, who, after he convicted the Nazis, he couldn't convict in 1932, he convicted them in 1946 and 47, with the help this time of the Americans, had the, not the gall, the bad taste, if you wish, to move back to Germany, and to live in Germany, and to practice law in Germany, after the Second World War again. So there seems to be this, with those people anyways, this almost diabolic relationship of needing to live amongst their victims, you know, which is to me, it is a sign of not a very healthy mind or frame of mind, you know. I mean, if I didn't like blacks, I wouldn't live amongst blacks, and if I didn't like Canadians, I wouldn't live here in Canada, you know, and if I assume as a Jew didn't like Germans or a certain kind of German, I wouldn't live there. This just seems the most natural thing. So there seems to be this need for the criminal to return to the scene of his crime. That's the only way that I can see it. Also, we have to remember that the Van Roden Commission that investigated the brutality that was practiced by these aliens in American uniform, they said that they wanted to have the executions halted and all the cases re-examined of those people who had already been convicted, and that while the public clamor was loud, indeed there was a stop of executions, and then very quietly the executions again 9 months later began to go on, so that the Allies, the Western Allies, we're not talking about communists here, you know, you're talking about civilized Christian men and officials and government, kept killing Germans who by now were their allies till 1900, well into the 1950s. And I don't know if you were aware that there are still Germans today in 1984 as prisoners in Holland, in France, in Italy, and of course in Spandau. Rudolf Hess. We don't even want to mention the Gulag of the Soviet Union, where there is undoubtedly thousands and thousands of Germans still serving in the mines, if they survived it up until now, that they are the forgotten victims. And it gives me great pain as a kind of a sensitive artist and a lover of justice that collectively the German people have not stood up and demanded the unconditional release of all those people before we pay one more cent in contributions to the United Nations, give one more soldier or pay one more cent towards NATO. In other words, if we are going to be made use of our bodies, our minds, our taxes, our labor, then we want to be treated as equals. That's point number two in Ernst Zündel's crusade. You know, after I have Nuremberg revised, I want to have the German people accepted as equals amongst nations, and certainly amongst those who call themselves our brothers in arms or our allies. You know, I would never ever tolerate this hypocrisy that especially the West Germans and the East Germans, as leaders of these two puppet states, display towards their respective masters. It's demeaning to the master. I think that it is a blot on America that they would keep puppets and vassals. You know, it's I consider it un-American. You know,
have you receive a lot of Jewish opposition? Have you ever been able to sit down in front of the cameras or in any type of a public debate and discuss these things with the Jews?
I have not been able to get what I had always wanted, a kind of a publicly televised broadcast, certainly publicly attended meeting, not for lack of trying. I have for about 15 years attempted to meet and reason with those people, because I know that they will have to face in the truth sooner or later, and that they have to face up to the truth of the research. But right now they have adopted this policy of the Dutch boy, you know, running around with the fingers in the dike everywhere as the cracks are appearing. Well, that's a defeating policy if I've ever seen one. They will unleash such a torrent when the break finally comes that it might well sweep them away. Individual Jewish people have actually helped me greatly. I have done some interviews with non-Zionist Jews who also believe that the Holocaust is bunk and suffer the same, if not worse, persecution than I do. I will have people come and be witnesses for me who are Jews, and they will state, exactly as I state, that the Holocaust is a World War II propaganda relic that has now kind of expanded into a global extortion racket. It is not, has nothing to do with human suffering. What we are looking at with the Holocaust, and this is the most important thing of all that I want to bring out to people that are listening to us, the trappings are emotional. All the tear-jerking presentations that you have ever heard about the flashing of the numbers and the tattooed lampshades and all this is propaganda to cloak, if not the largest, but certainly one of the largest extortion rackets, this time perpetrated on an entire people. They have elevated parasitism to the globe, to a global level. And now that the German host is weakening and the old people are dying off, the young ones no longer feel guilty, people like myself who had nothing to do with whatever happened there, they refuse to pay. And so now the Americans are being worked on, the American psyche. America already is paying these guilt payments, believe it or not, because they did not do something while they should have done something. I have heard one famous Nazi hunter, a man of some 84 years, give a lecture here in Toronto. We have him on tape, where he says that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was an anti-Semite. I don't know if he said worse than Hitler, but certainly almost worse than Hitler, you know. Winston Churchill, the same thing. The Prime Minister of Canada, the same thing. In other words, everybody was guilty because they did not look first out after their own people's interests, but they looked, they didn't look out after Jewish interests first, you know, but they looked out after their own people's interests, so they thought, you know. So You can expect, as the 1980s unravel, that the propaganda will shift away slightly from the Germans, and that everybody else will also be guilty, because now, you know, they're going to get 10% from the Americans, 10% from the Canadians, and 10% from the Brits, and 5% maybe from the Aussies, and they get another 10% from the Poles. Maybe they got tough going there, but oh, the Dutch are good for some lena, and the French too. So all these European nations will be guilty of not having done enough for the Jews during the Second World War. And you will see this. This is going to be, as we are facing, German payments are going down. Israel is in terrible financial straits, because you see what they had gotten used to is to rely on those German guilt payments to make up a very large part of their budget. And just like in America, certain groups are getting hooked on welfare, the Israeli state had gotten hooked on those German guilt payments. And as they're going down, they're scrambling for other sources. And right now the Americans, unfortunately or fortunately, it actually serves them right as a people, that they should go to war totally needlessly against Germany and give us a hard time, because they went out on this great crusade to Europe to save Jews, you know, ultimately, since they had no territorial aims, it seems, and didn't make any other financial gains in the Second World War. They went on this crusade to save Jews, and now these very same people are coming back to haunt them in America and to put the lien on them and to squeeze to them. So in a way, you could say there is kind of an eternal justice being worked here. However, I'm too nice of a fellow to gloat while it's happening to Americans, because basically I like Americans. I think we should not compound one injustice with another injustice.
Could you talk a moment about your legal problems that you're having? It seems that it's the Canadian government that's giving you most of your problems. Is that true?
Only half true, in a way, because my problems stem from Jewish individuals and some Jewish organizations who cloaked themselves into being Jewish. They used the good name of the Jews, you know, the warmth that extends to these people because of the Holocaust propaganda. But they are, in effect, Zionists by political persuasion, or communists. And they are what I refer to as professional Jews. You know, they make a living at being Jews. You know, their profession is being a Jew. And you can imagine that they have people that they are responsible to in the organization who pay their salaries. These people draw salaries, maybe $20,000, $30,000 a year, I don't know, maybe some even more. And they have to deliver it. You see, when they have their annual meetings or 3 monthly meetings or whatever, the person has to have a sheet and says, look at what I did for the Jews. My job is being a professional Jew. I have to do something good for the Jews. And so he has to, or she has to, point out to headlines that she has generated that were for the Jews, against people like myself who want to revise this history, you know. So we're dealing here again not with a moral issue, but strictly a dollar and cents issue, you know. And these Zionists have managed, through clever manipulation of politicians and by getting their ears, to actually use the taxpayers' money to make life difficult for people like myself.
Cut. You any idea how I'm about? Sir, could you comment on the trial that's going on now and tell us a little bit about it?
I'll be somewhat less direct than I usually am, because, you know, there's a sub judice rule where we cannot discuss details that will be coming out in the trial. But what I can say to you is that this is, for me, not the first trial. This is round number 3 against my opponents. I was charged in Ottawa by the Canadian government again in a situation which is kind of an unusual thing. Maybe you don't have that in the United States. It was an administrative tribunal. It was tantamount to a court. There were lawyers there and there was a panel of judges there. And the interesting thing is that the Zionists had brought their own legal team which was sitting across from me, right beside the Canadian government lawyer and the Canadian government witnesses. And so I was cross-examined when the Canadian government lawyer was through. I was cross-examined by the Jewish lawyer, which is, in the United States, you would call that double jeopardy, which would be immediately illegal. But in Canada, this was perfectly acceptable to the Canadian system. Well, we attended the longest postal hearing in Ottawa. The case was basically that the Minister of Post had removed my right or privilege, as he called it, to send mail and to receive mail. Now, you can imagine, I sent material to some 41 countries in sometimes up to 14 languages, you know. I mean, we have sent material in Ukrainian, in Arabic, and in English, Italian, German, French. And to deny me the right to communicate via the mails was a very, very dangerous move. And I had thought that something like that might come up one day and had contingency plans for it. So I was able to continue our operation. But in Ottawa, we fought for the right on principle. Again, not for me alone, but for all the Canadians, that no minister could do that ever again, with a stroke of a pen, remove a business firm's or an individual's right to receive or to send mail through the mails before going to court. You see, it has always been in the past practice in this Anglo-Saxon-based country to be innocent until you were proven guilty. In my case, I was guilty before I could prove my innocence, which in fact I did. And in the longest postal hearing in Canadian history, apparently so convinced these three judges who were sitting in judgment over this case that after about a year, I regained my postal rights, in no small measure due to the help supplied from people all over the world, many of them Americans, some of them Jews, who supplied me with documentations and rare books and affidavits and so on that won our case. And reluctantly, the same Minister of Canada Post who had deprived me of my postal right had to give me back the postal right. Now you can imagine, I felt pretty good about this. In the meantime, in West Germany, the same elements had gotten the ear of the politicians, and the West German puppet regime had sent the largest police force ever assembled in West Germany, in the history of West Germany, some people say even in the history of Germany, to raid in one single night over 2,000 homes, depending on whom you believe in, you know. Der Spiegel said 600, others said 680, 700, 1,500, 2,000. Well, by the number of complaints that I got and letters of descriptions of the raids that I got from my own supporters, it would have to be in the neighborhood of about 2,000 now. In each case, there were 6, 7, 8, sometimes 10 police officials involved, judges, prosecutors, that we estimate that there were 10,000 police officers, 300 prosecutors, and about 50 judges involved in those two nights of raids in West Germany. Now, what they seized were, and that is the interesting thing, West Germany has constitutional guarantees in their basic law that you can inform yourselves across the borders, you know, you can receive information from outside the country, that you have the right of free speech and free opinion, and all this, we have all the rights that are on paper and look so nice, and which people who don't have any ideas and never need to speak in public or write down a thought and propagate a thought, think that they have. The moment when you actually need the paragraph to protect a thinker who dares to think the unthinkable, like I do in my case with the Holocaust, we found there were no constitutional protections, no guarantees. These people's doors were kicked down or hammered in, and locks were broken, and little old ladies of 80, the oldest person that was raided was 93 years old, and they came at 1 o'clock at night.
Well, you know, what was the outcome of all this?
The outcome of it was that they hauled away truckloads full of tape recordings, pamphlets, and books. They were particularly interested in my tape recordings. You see, I run like a tape ministry to my friends because I have long ago found that the spoken word is more comforting to them, and some of these people are busy, so they play it while they're driving to work or whatever. And so I have distributed on a free will offering basis, tens of thousands of tapes all over the world, you know, and the police would storm in, wave their search warrants, where are the tapes? And then I have a little green booklet, which is my life story and gives instructions for people what they can do to help freedom along, you know. And next thing was, where's the green book, you know? And then they'd haul all my private correspondence, all my newsletters, everything that emanated from me would be put into evidence bags and hauled away. They opened up a central office in the southern city of Stuttgart where the trial was going to take place. I engaged a German attorney, a young man, considerably younger than myself, but a fellow who has his mind and his heart in the right spot, and he consented to defend me there, and apparently, again, with the material that I sent to him and his own brilliant legal work, and also the lack of evidence on the government side, because I am extremely cautious in what I say. Whatever I say is usually backed up by facts, is truthful, and is not said in a hurtful manner, you know. And so because I don't go around, what we say in English is Jew baiting, you know, and hurling insults at those people or making threats. You see, I'm a little different from most nationalist leaders or groups and so on. I don't hate Jews, you know, and I feel rather uncomfortable with this label of being an anti-Semite. You know, it has nothing to do with me disliking these people collectively for what they are. I dislike intensely, even hate their evil deeds. You know? Mm-hmm. What I want to do is replace their consciousness, which they have acquired, like we all acquire it through reading and parents and television and schools and universities, where they were crammed full of lies. I want to share my information, which I know is truthful and I know would help free them from these shackles and imprisonment of their own spirit, you know. And if I can do that, everybody will be helped, Jew and Gentile, you know. I want them to go on their merry way. I don't care if they establish six Israels, you know. But they ought to do it by themselves, not by the sweat of my German people's money. And also not by making us feel so terribly guilty for sins which we never committed.
How about your latest trial here, the one that's going on now?
The trial in Canada is round three. Same person that was responsible for having my postal rights revoked, same Jewish individual, same Zionist functionary, same professional Jew, a woman. She had been agitating for years to get at me, you know. And of course there's competition amongst these Zionist organizations. And she wanted to be upfront, you know. She wanted to slay the quote, Nazi dragon on Carlton Street. And so she found the politician's ears once again, and she obviously, by the way it developed, had arranged or had the approval of or was given to understand, makes no difference. Subsequent events will show that she laid a charge against me with a private complaint by one individual. She was swearing out this complaint to a justice of the peace, which got me first summoned to go to court. When I arrived in court the first time, there were these terrible demonstrations where I was spat at, and my attorney was spat at and kicked and punched, and I was knocked to the ground on the courthouse steps. And there were these howls of screaming young Zionists from the Jewish Defense League and some older people shaking their fists at us and so on. The crown, in like the government in the United States, was not ready. The state was not ready with the case. So within 5 minutes, it was all over, and we had to fight our way out of the courtroom again, out of the courthouse. And in a subsequent court appearance, they were not ready again. You know, I mean, they had 25 years that I've been doing my work in this country. You should have thought that these Nazi hunters had their act together, you know, and they were able to present the crown, the state, with the evidence at that stage to virtually put me away if I was as evil as the media makes me out to be. They were not ready again. And by that time, the judge was getting pretty angry, you know, because every time I had to run the gauntlet. And that time we were faced by thugs. And I mean, they were fist fights, wrestling matches, punching and kicking on the courthouse steps. The screaming was something else. You know, and I was hit over the head with demonstrator signs, and luckily I wore a helmet, a safety helmet, to protect myself. And on the way from the courthouse, one of my friends was waylaid and kicked and punched in full view of the TV cameras. Now, the judge at that time was very short and very angry with the prosecution. He said, now, you have exactly 3 weeks to bring the material, or else, meaning, I was going to throw it out of court. And apparently in the chambers, in private, the judge was very hostile to the prosecution. And so when February 6th, 1984 rolled around, my third court appearance, suddenly I found myself, the old charge was dropped. It was no longer a matter of this woman charging me, but now it was suddenly a government charge. And so the government, using the taxpayers' money, is now prosecuting me, obviously on behalf of the people who brought the thing in the first place. Now, we have had subsequent preliminary hearing, which lasted some 2 weeks, where again the government, at the taxpayers' expense, was flying in people from all over North America. One of them was an American, in quote, one of those men with strange accents in American uniform, I suppose, who Patton and Wennerström were mentioning. His name is Dr. John Fried, and they brought him up. He's 80 years old, and he had one more chance to do battle against the demons of the Nazis, you know. And they brought in Dr. Raoul Hilberg, a professor, virtually of Holocaustology, you know. He has made a kind of a lifetime thing out of going through the dustbin of history and finding out how many people supposedly were gassed here and gassed there. So he was government witness. Many people felt it was indecent the way how openly the government was presenting only the Jewish side, in quotes, you know, because after all, there were other people involved in these trials. Why they just had to rely on only Jewish witnesses, you know. So I was rather glad that they did, because it showed to the public and to those interested in these issues that once again, the Germans, this time personified through me, I just consider myself a vehicle in this struggle, we are facing off against their tormentors, if you wish, you know. And so after 2 weeks of the preliminary hearing, I was put to bound over for trial, they call it. But they didn't set a trial date. So on August the 9th, I had to once again go to court. Each court appearance, every day, of course, is associated with a danger of assassination, a danger of bombs going off or physical attacks. And it's interesting that the police force in Toronto takes this very seriously. In numerous meetings with me, we have coordinated a very tight security, from the security standpoint, plan of getting me from my office to the courthouse, out of the courthouse, and the cooperation that I've had from police officials is magnificent. There's no complaints on my side there. The politicians look terrible in comparison to what the police officials look like. The media, of course, we won't even bother to mention. But the problem that I foresee with the trial is not the trial itself, however difficult that might be, since I'm facing the endless resources, really, of the state pitted against me, the individual, not even my publishing house, you see. I'm sued as the individual, not as the publishing house. And so I'm pitting myself against the might of the state. So this is really a David Goliath kind of a situation. And I don't fear that as much as I fear that they won't let me live long enough to make it into the courthouse, to present my evidence. And once, you know, every day that I am going to be able to witness in the courthouse, I will consider a victory, you know, because I will, for the first time in 40 years, present material which the people of North America and the world have not seen. And of course, I'm somewhat of a propagandist, you know, that has a negative connotation, but in the true sense of the word, advertising is really what you could call propaganda, you know, and I propagate my ideas, and in this case, I'm going to use the courtroom to propagate these ideas. And for the first time in 40 years, all this nebulous, wishy-washy claim, counterclaim, so many gold teeth, so many pounds of hair, so much human soap, all this stuff is going to come out in a court of law, and I have every confidence that even if we were not to win the case, so many facts are going to be nailed down through cross-examination by my attorneys and through introduction of evidence and expert witnesses that the Holocaust, as you and I have known it in our existence here in North America, will never be the same again. So this will be the apex. I believe, you know, in all humbleness, I believe that we will break the neck of the Holocaust lie with this trial. And from then on, all subsequent trials have my evidence to fall back on. So even if I should lose, I will win. And our people will win. And I don't mean only the German people. The people, the Aryan certainly will be kind of having this guilt complex, I think, if not totally lifted, at least partially removed. Because, you know, when in the United Nations a person from the third world gets up and talks about you people, the Westerners, they call us there, you know, the West, the capitalist countries, you were responsible for this mass murder, and they regurgitate all these Zionist lies. You know, they make us collectively guilty. I've heard it so many times in these United Nations debates, you know, where these third world tyrants and demagogues, you know, get up and they give collectively, Englishmen, Frenchmen, Americans, Canadians, Brits even, a bad name because allegedly this white-skinned devil living in the heart of Europe did such dastardly things to those nice Jews, you know. So I think that with our trial, this will come to an end.
Well, you seem very optimistic. You apparently think that you're winning your battles. And what do you see beyond this? What is your mission in life, and what do you hope to accomplish other than waking up the German people? Where are you going to go after that?
The world is my home. It's actually only by coincidence that I stumbled into this issue, you know. It just suddenly took on a life all of its own, and it is an issue that I feel duty-bound to see through, you know. I don't know why that is, but that's the way it is with me, you know. I'm not a fellow that leaves too many loose ends dangling in my private life, and so therefore I don't like to leave loose ends dangling in my public life, if you wish. I think that once a truth is perceived, and it is one that is so important and can be healing, you know, my opposition accuses me that I'm a rabble-rouser and I'm a disturber of the peace. The charge in court says that I disturb the racial and social harmony in Canada with my writings. Far from the truth. You know, I'm like a man who says, this man or this group of people are gangsters. They are members of the mafia. Well, the first thing that these guys will say to all and sundry is, he's accusing me wrongly. You know, they would be called by the proper name. And so by me pointing out these people are extortionists, naturally they're going to move heaven and earth to shut me up. But is my truth not socially redeeming? I am the Paul Revere of the nationalist movement. You know, I'm riding down Carlton Street saying the Zionists are coming, because coming with all this lie about the Holocaust, this is only the tip of the spear. With that, these people have gained power in our society far out of proportion to what they ought to have numerically speaking, or what they should have from their intellectual capacity or their qualifications and so on. You know, they are hogging power in administrative jobs thanks to the Holocaust propaganda. And I want everybody in this society to rise to the top based on what they do and what they say and their merits, not by what somebody might have done to their fathers or might not have done to their fathers, you know. And our society is in such poor shape, especially in North America, because we have rotten leadership. And we have rotten leadership in part due to the Holocaust propaganda lie. And with this solution, coming to grips and the exposure and the settling and the solving of the Holocaust problem, will come crashing down this whole edifice of lies, you know. And boy, we will be like liberated. We will be like unshackled prisoners. We'll be like eagles that have been, you know, their iron balls cut loose, you know, from their legs. And we will be able to once again soar with the eagles. This is our destiny, you know. Not be fettered down there in the quagmire of these lies and half-truths and distortion and emotional propaganda. This is not us. You know, we as a people, I don't speak only the Germans, but the Aryans, we are the great conquerors, the great truth seekers. We are the great explorers, the road builders, you know, Panama Canal builders, Suez Canal builders. You know, we are the ones that actually now are probing the outer edges of the universe. That's our role. And if we free ourselves from this spiritual monkey on our back, there will be no holding. You know, I know this is all pretty lofty and heady stuff that we are discussing here, and I don't want to kind of baffle you with highfalutin phrases, because really the work needs to be done down here on earth. You know, that's where all liberation begins. And I think the most natural way that I can tell you what my plans are really is to tell you what I did and what I do. It is the most natural thing that every individual can do. It's an act of first inner liberation through information. But some people, they stop at this level. They think that to study and to learn the facts is the end all and the be all. Well, I found that many of my book customers, unfortunately, remain just as bookworms. You know, they kind of turn the stereo down low and put on some nice inoffensive piece of classical music. They settle down comfortably in their couch and they read how bad the enemy all is, you know. And by the time the evening is through, they are so down by the information, because the enemy by now looks so formidable and powerful that the hand that was to swing the sword is paralyzed due to information overload. You know, the mind, after all, is what makes us ultimately go. You see, there's where the command center is located. And I mean, there is so much information out on our opposition that, realistically speaking, nobody ever should oppose these people, you know. But the human spirit and the thirst for freedom, I think, especially in our race, is so all-powerful and consuming, especially in those who tend to become leaders because they are natural leaders, born leaders, that they will find ways and means of doing it just the way I did. I studied and studied, and I could give you answers of the most intricate details about far-flung conspiracies, but it led to nothing until I started out by, with two fingers, typing my first pamphlet on an old second-hand typewriter which I bought, and then distributing this pamphlet. And I sent that to Boy Scouts, veterans organizations, to businessmen's clubs, Kiwanis, Rotarians, Freemasonic lodges. At the time, I didn't know any better, you know. And I asked these people if they needed a speaker so that I could speak on the evils of communism to our civilization. Now, I had researched a nice little speech. I had taken some public speaking lessons, and I had read all the Dale Carnegie books of How to Win Friends and Influence People, and the American writer Napoleon Hill has been quite an influence on me in this respect for organizing and presenting facts. And so when I thought I was prepared, except for the shyness angle which I felt, I knew I had to polish that, you know, that I should be more well-rounded and soft-spoken and so on. So then these people didn't know this, but my letter really was to inform them as well as to teach me, you see. And I took a tape recorder along to listen to what I had said after the meeting was over in the evenings while I was doing my graphic arts work, and polished myself. And I have found the most important tool, teaching device, that we have available to us today is an audio tape recorder, or now a video tape recorder. Because this will, if we are at all critical of ourselves, most people are, we will be able to kind of round our presentation out and make us better speakers with a better delivery and so on. So I would recommend that anybody that loves freedom and wants to serve his fellow man, that he work first on himself and do the best job that he can, and do it exactly the way I did it. By all means, you must do it by real life action. That's why in every army you have live fire exercises, you know. And so I faced the live fire of the questioners after the meeting was over and so on. That was my first act of liberation to activity. And when I saw how I was received, it was amazing. And I mean, I was certainly not a God-gifted orator. I was just an ordinary young man and artist in a strange language, which was to me English. I only learned English when I was 18 years old. And that immediately led to studying French and also giving my first talks in French, because I knew that in a country like Canada and in the world, these two Aryan languages still were a very important tool, and I'm ever glad that I did. You know, so I went to night school to improve my linguistic skills, went to university to improve my historical skills and also keep my mind active and alert. But in the meantime, I send out these flyers and then subsequent flyers in a kind of a speaker's bureau. And I used to get paid $2, $5, $10, $20 was the biggest. The biggest amount I ever got was $25 for doing a 2-hour radio show. Now I have done whole hour TV programs nationally broadcast and didn't get a dime for them, of course, as you usually don't get paid for those things, you know. But it gave me the experience and also with it the exposure. Then I graduated from the speaking by collecting adherents. I seem to have moved a number of people, and these people would say to me, but Mr. Zündel, you know, you're saying all those things, and is there anything we can do? And at first, I had no method of making those people do anything because I wasn't prepared for this, you see, self-taught as I was. And then I realized, gee, there's all these people offering this help. Of course, I've got to do something. There was your first mail-out and flyer. So I would sit down and write something, and an English-Canadian friend would correct it so it was proper grammatically and type it for me professionally, you know. And then a few thousand of them run off. The next thing you know, my basement and my living room was filled with people, volunteers, all ages, all ethnic groups, coming together, sitting on the long table under, my wife would make coffee and cakes and so on, you know. And we'd stuff sometimes thousands and thousands of things. Now, we directed those to ministers of the various denominations, churches, priests, school teachers, parliamentarians, newspapers. Because I was in advertising, it was easy for me. I obtained mailing lists and stuff like this. And quite naturally, the form followed the function. It became evident that I needed to have an organization, you know. First there was one man, there were some helpers, there were more helpers. Then there were more helpers than one man could handle, you know. And so suddenly there were groups in different cities. And finally there were correspondents around the world, contacts. And it just snowballed. And it was all self-taught with the help of a couple of books. But it is really common sense. And I want to warn people against setting up elaborate flow charts of, you know, from one department to the other. No, we have to be creative and living because we have to improvise. You know, we are like an army that is living off the land and getting its recruits as we fight. You know, this is our role at this time. And we have to be lean and efficient. And that's the way that you remain that if you don't get bogged down in a kind of a static defense operation. The newsletter was followed by regular newsletters, then by guest appearances on radio shows, 1 hour, 2 hour, half an hour. Then obviously I needed to get people to receive my thoughts, so can publish a publication of a booklet of what I intended to do. And then this was such a success that people wanted to have more. They wrote back, was there anything else? Well, then I realized there was a market because somebody had to finance this kind of growing operation. And so I wrote a couple of books, some of my far out subjects like Flying Saucers, which were runaway bestsellers, which got me more television appearances, more radio appearances. I was invited to be a guest speaker to UFO conventions, to psychic conventions. And always I would introduce this philosophic and political note, you see. So it all came, one came to the other, but then I realized that all this was basically intellectual stuff, you know. It wasn't changing anything because although I was reaching millions of people, I was informing these people, we had no plan to change something, you know. I left these people to their own devices and ever more requests came in, what can you do? So then I would fly across the country, across the continent to as far away as Australia, South Africa, Western Europe, and meet these people and set up little groups that would be almost like clones under local leadership and would do the same thing that we did. Now, that meant that I now had to inform those people regularly. This is where the tape recording idea came in, you see? I would speak onto a tape recording, sometimes while I was on a plane, sometimes while I was driving my car even, edit the tape together, and on a monthly basis or on a bi-weekly basis, depending on what issues were being discussed, mail that out to them. So this was like an intellectual corset, a support system, also encouragement to them. And when we had little victories and we were, for instance, demonstrating, let's say, by that time, I asked these people to mount demonstrations worldwide. We were responsible in some 14 countries having mounted anti-Holocaust demonstrations during the Holocaust showing internationally. So I thought that was pretty good. And it was so successful, our demonstrations, by those same people that I had organized and kind of coalesced together through my writings, my thoughts, my tape recordings, that I had a phone call, for instance, from South Africa, Johannesburg, South Africa, from the manager of Der Spiegel, which is Germany's largest newsweekly, down to the bureau manager, bureau chief. And he says, Mr. Zündel, would you please call back your demonstrators? You are embarrassing us. There is these Germans and these Africans, these white South Africans demonstrating outside our office. You know, you're damaging the reputation of Germany. I said, you hypocrites, for years you have been damaging the reputation of the German people with all your lies of the Holocaust and so on. And now you come pleading to me that I should call my friends off your backs because you want to keep on telling your lies. I said, no such thing. Number one, I'm not their chief, you know. I just asked them if they would, and they do, but they are under local command. If you want to speak to the man, and if you come to terms with that man in South Africa, then I'm quite sure if he checks back with me, and if you agree to stop your lies, or to tone them down at least, or to tell some truth for a change once in a while, then we will certainly be amenable. We don't get interested in creating a problem for anybody, least of all our German people. Within 2 days, as the compromise solution was worked out, I had a reporter team here from New York City. They flew all the way to Toronto to interview me, and they promised that they were going to write some articles about the Holocaust and the Anne Frank thing, and they did. It was Der Spiegel who broke the Anne Frank story in their magazine, and this was very important to us because Der Spiegel is not only read nationally in Germany as the largest newsweekly, it is read around the world by decision makers. And they have a circulation of some 4 million, I believe, and readership in well into the 6 or 7 million people. So it is a very influential magazine. So you see what I mean, that first through thought leading to action, well, first research, then the information led through thought, thought led to action, action then led to ever larger action, and finally there was interaction with different groups. And in the end, we had even demonstrators on the street. Now, in political science, any political science textbook worthy of the title will tell you that for every writer of a letter, there is 100 people who feel like the person who writes the letter. For every demonstrator on the street, there is at least 1,000 people that feel like that person. Now, you can imagine, if you can get 30 or 40 people on a demonstration, the local system knows that there are tens of thousands of people that are dissatisfied with what is going on. Also, you force the media, which is in the hand of our enemies usually, to cover you because you are visible. Thousands of people driving by your demonstration, they see your message. And you see, then you have your own people call the various newspapers, the competitors, and you say to them, oh, I drove by down at, let's say, the Toronto Star today, and I saw these demonstrations. How come nothing in your newspaper about this, you know? Are you suppressing the news and stuff like this? And if you put the heat under the media, sooner or later they will report your demonstrations, you know? We have had fantastic results brought to us through demonstrations, but demonstrations alone will not do it. It is almost like an army that has tanks and half tracks and heavy machine guns, light machine guns, pistols, hand grenades, mortars, artillery. In our arsenal of this fight for the truth, we also have to have all these various branches of our activities. For instance, it was usually the demonstrations that would attract the electronic media, you see? The electronic media then broadcasting would bring a story in the print media the day after, you see? Then when this activity was unfolding, television would get into the act, you know? And as we became experienced, of course, I usually invited the media, gave them advanced warning. You develop a personal relationship with some of the editors. You feed them special stories, do them special favors, you know. You even pre-write a story for them that they can then just amend and publish. This is just human nature, you know. And if I have got an inordinate amount of press in Canada, and now it seems also in Western Europe and America, it's basically due that I pander almost to the media. You see, I believe that our enemies, our spiritual enemies, are so few. The evil that has grafted itself upon our body politic is so, they are so few in numbers that they have many of our own people in their employ. These people in their hearts many times know what the problem is, and they certainly know it organizationally, that they are blocked from advancement because enemy people are already in place, either they are communists or Zionists or whatever, you know. And I have found so many allies within the media. It's fantastic. I would caution anyone, any leader that would say, don't talk to the media. You know, it's true, it's a double-edged sword. But while we are still in this weakened state, we need to rely on the channels of the media. Can you imagine the magnificent national networks that these people have set up, that I am allowing them to pay the salaries and deal with the FCC and all these regulatory agencies? Costs me not a dime. I don't even have to pay the taxes to the local civic hall for anything, you know. The media does all that for me. And if I can get 5 minutes or 10 minutes on local and national media, this is going to be worth tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of stamps, pamphlets, and so on. Because increasingly, our own people are turning away from informing themselves by research. They get the primary information today obtained everywhere in the Western world comes through television and through radio, and only then through newspapers, you see? And by being able to play to all the branches of the media the way we do, through demonstrations, through lectures, Holocaust symposiums, colorful signs and demonstrations, one-man demonstrations, visits to politicians, and all this kind of stuff, and always bringing along our own media with it. It's another very important point, that the media doesn't feel embarrassed if they are the only photographer there. If you have three or four of your own crew already snapping away with pictures, that fellow thinks they're also media people, you see? And so you create a feeling of competition. Also, you take the fear away from the local media, thinking that they are not, they're going to be pounced on if they only write about it, you know? So you have to show what we call in German Fingerspitzengefühl, the tip of your fingers, you know. You have to always train yourself to be alert and seize every opportunity where the enemy is holding a meeting. You know they will bring all their enemy media there. Then you spoil it for them by arriving with 10, 15, 20 men carrying placards. And even if you wrench from them 1 minute or 30 seconds or a minute and a half from primetime television, this is 1.5 minutes which you didn't have. And I have become a national figure by stealing the limelight away from our enemies. And it's interesting, I don't know if Jesse Jackson was copying me during his campaign, but that man and his campaign team, they were past masters in elbowing in. You know, for instance, long before that Jesse Jackson ran for president, he had some turkey walk behind him, always carrying a sign, "Run, Jesse, run," or "Jesse for president," you know? So every time Jesse Jackson was photographed, there was the damn sign, signaling to millions and millions of potential Jesse Jackson fans, blacks, Hispanics, and so on, that here, this guy is going to be grooming himself for the leadership now. Some people laughed at that. I just learned from that, you see? I think that from the point of view of the media being the message, it was a very good idea, and we should not disdain the media. You know, I think that it is our duty to use the media wherever we can. And since we are weak for the moment in many communities, we must rely on others to create the issues, and then we exploit them. And sooner or later, we will pull even, and then we will get equal time, or then we create the issues, you see. But the one message that I could give to our people is, take an example on me. You know, you can do it. I'm serious about it, you know. Use the media, be kind. For instance, I was recently at one court appearance from another person accused, similarly to like myself, and one of his adherents was going to swing at one of the photographers in full view of the press. Now, that press photographer maybe had it coming to him, but nevertheless, we should never do that. Always control yourself. Don't allow your own individual passion or likes or dislike to spoil the overall thing. The moment when we get involved in this struggle for freedom, we no longer speak for ourselves. You see, that's the very important point, that we can no longer, through a curse or a cuss word or something, where we kind of feel better once we have said it, spoil something for millions of people. And I have coined the phrase, if you want to be president, then act like the president. Act presidentially, you know. And I think each person, by striving to be presidential, will become a better person. You see, we have to constantly work on ourselves. And also, when it comes to rhetoric in the media, try not to be so damn hateful. Many of our people are so angered by what is happening that all we present to this big TV screen where the camera is going to zoom in on us is this distorted face with starry eyes, you know, making us look like we are a bunch of glazed-eyed fanatics. You know, we are not. We are people concerned about the survival of our own. Of course, we speak with the eloquence of emergency in our voice, but that's very good, because there's millions of people out there wanting to hear what we have to say, but we also have to say it packaged in such a way that we don't scare them half to death, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because we love our people. We don't hate our people.
Well, you know, it's obvious that you're a determined and effective man, and I'd like to ask you, why? Do you feel that you're being pushed, that a divine hand is guiding your path? Or how do you explain how you are?
Yeah, well, in German we have a good word for that. It's called Sendungsbewusstsein. And this is people, as they mature and become part of a cause, suddenly realize that they are part of something which is beyond themselves. You know, we all know when we go and shave in the morning, look in the mirror and brush our teeth, who we are. We know our weaknesses better than anybody else, you know, and we all have our foibles, but there comes within us a recognition after we have been tested under fire and have faced all kinds of dangers and so on, that there is something about us as individuals that is unique. And it won't take long for somebody to realize that something chose you, someone maybe chose you to do this job. And yes, I also believe that I have a job to do, that my person is only the vehicle for it. And before I do TV shows or anything that is important, I always say kind of a silent prayer, which is that, I mean, kind of sum total, that I don't do this job for the greater glory of Ernst Zündel, or that I would get my name in the paper, or that people will see my face on the television. In other words, it's almost like a self-abrogation, you know, and that I put my own personality away from it and say, I do this for the greater glory of truth and of my own people. And usually, it gives me terrific strength, you know, and I'm inspired with answers that sometimes when I listen to the tape or go back over court transcripts, I look at that and I say, do you mean to say I said that? You know, I could think this. It amazes me myself. So I believe that if we plug in to divine guidance, that we will be given it if we show ourselves worthy. And we show ourselves worthy by doing and giving the very best that we can. And I feel that I'm protected. I should have long ago had some problems, bombs go off. I'm safe, you know. Meetings are busted up, I come out safe. Courthouse battles are fought on the way in and the way out, I come out unscratched. There comes a point when you have to think that this is more than coincidence. So to answer your question, yes, I believe that I, up until this time in my life, have walked under almost divine protection.
Well, Mr. Zundel, I want to thank you very much for your time today. It's been interesting, and we certainly appreciate what you've given us.
Well, I thank you for coming up.